Here's some books that may prove helpful. Non-Adventist authors, but just very intelligent and incisive in what they've researched and thought. Jonathan Wells, Icons of Evolution. And then from Michael Behe, Darwin's Black Box. If you order that one is heavy to get through, but we'll be looking at two big features that he mentions in that book. And the last one I'll mention is Lee Strobel, The Case for a Creator. Maybe some of you have that book. Any of those would be good books with which to refer. So take a look at the next scene, ASIMO, which means Advanced Step in Innovative Mobility. Honda has been developing this since the mid-80s. And a little contrast, our lady E.G. White said that Adam was more than twice as tall as men now living. So basing his statistics with ASIMO's, Adam, 14 feet tall, ASIMO, 4 feet 3 inches. ASIMO, 119 pounds, and if you scale up Adam's height and weight based on an average six-footer, he would weigh 2,500 pounds. Can you imagine him tromping through the Garden of Eden? And Eve knew when he was coming with the noise that he could make. ASIMO can play games. He can walk at 1.7 miles an hour. And it's predicted that Adam, in a leisurely pace, could walk 7 miles an hour. ASIMO can run 3.7 miles an hour. And Adam could probably do 38 at least. About 90 seconds for the mile. ASIMO runs on a 51.8 volt lithium ion battery. Adam ran on creator designed metabolism. This battery can last about 90 minutes for ASIMO. For Adam, he was built for eternity until he screwed it all up. ASIMO can follow your voice. Adam communed with his creator. ASIMO, at this point, they've been revising him, can recognize up to 10 different faces. Adam probably could recognize all of his progeny. Could have been thousands, and he knew them by name. ASIMO has been developed since the mid-80s, as I said. How long did it take God to create Adam? One day. Or less, on that sixth day. ASIMO, he can be programmed to speak with a woman's voice or a man's voice. He can't decide which he wants to be. Adam was definitely male, and beautiful Eve was definitely female. Quite a bit difference between what Adam is and what ASIMO was designed to be, and they're still trying to make him to be very much more human-like. So the question comes, fearfully and wonderfully evolved, designed, or made? Mankind has been curious about what goes on inside his own body for centuries, and we delve deeper and deeper into the human body, and here's a picture of them trying to analyze and take apart a human. And this developed over centuries our knowledge of anatomy and physiology. And I am not a biologist. I taught chemistry and physics and math. So some of this that I'm going to speak about is way beyond what I understand. But it's fun to talk about it anyway. So we look at the microscopic world. Do you know what these are? Well, they say that this caption under it said it was Purkinje neurons, which is in your cerebral cortex of all vertebrates. So without those, you couldn't decide what you wanted for lunch or recognize your partner. Do you know what these are? Now you're afraid to, somebody may have said it. These are the little hairs that are in your inner ear. And if you play your tunes too loud, you're going to break some of those off. And here I am at the ripe old age of 76. Or is it 77? Whatever. 76, I guess it is. And I can still hear pretty well. I don't have to wear a hearing aid. But you can ruin those things, and they don't grow back very easy. So be careful. this one you're going to need when you leave here to eat your lunch. So what do you think that is? Taste bud. Yeah. I'm looking forward to lunch today at my friend's house, the Walters. This one you're using right now. I guess there's more than one. Alveoli in your lungs. Some people say it's alveoli. Depends on how Italian you are, maybe. But look at those things. You could not take in the oxygen you need without those. So we turn now to Michael Behe. He was listed as the second author in those books that I mentioned. He is Dr. Behe. He is at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. And he has researched molecular trucks and highways. Brothers and sisters, we are descending into the very tiny, the very small. Can you even see a human cell with your naked eye? And these trucks run around inside your cells. So these are not these big 18-wheelers. And if you had his book, Darwin's Black Box, on page 101 and onward, he describes these trucks and highways that are in your cells right now and that are functioning very well. The cell is not just a simple bag of soup with everything sloshing around, he said. Instead, eukaryotic cells of all organisms except bacteria, have a number of compartments, sort of like rooms in a house. And look at all those things. I mean, that's more complicated than I want to go through or even think about. But I guess molecular biologists have to know this and much, much more than what's appearing on this slide. There's the nucleus where the DNA resides, the mitochondria which produce energy, endoplasmic reticulum which produces proteins, the Golgi apparatus which is a way station for proteins that are being transported elsewhere, the lysosome which is a garbage disposal unit, a little smaller than that. Secretory vesicles, which store cargo before it's sent out of the cell. And the peroxisome, which helps metabolize fats. Each compartment is sealed off by a membrane. This is all inside of one cell. Little membranes, just like a room has walls. And importantly, a door. In fact, the mitochondrion has four separate sections itself. Counting everything, there are more than 20 different sections in each cell in your body right now. Back when I was a kid and took biology, and I don't know when the knowledge of cell and DNA even came, they didn't know about the helix when I went to school. This was what we learned. That's what it looked like when I went to school and Barb went to school. Connie, was yours about like that too, back at Platte Valley? We just thought, you know, there's this bag of soup and there's the nucleus, cytoplasm and the mitochondria, and that's about all we had to learn about it. And certainly even perhaps that much wasn't known by Darwin. It's changed a lot. The cells are constantly getting rid of old stuff and manufacturing new stuff. And there are components that are designed to work in one room but not in others. And most new components are made at a central location in the cell on things called ribosomes. Michael Denton, this is Dr. Michael Denton, has done a lot of research on the ribosomes. He's a research fellow at the University of Otago, New Zealand. And Behe quotes him in his book. These are two Michaels, not the same Michael. Denton has described the ribosome, a collection of some 50 large molecules containing more than 1 million atoms. I don't understand all these numbers. As an automated factory that can synthesize any protein that is instructed to do so by the DNA. Given the correct genetic information, in fact, it can construct any protein-based biological machine, including another ribosome like itself, regardless of the complexity. It is astonishing to think that this remarkable piece of machinery, so tiny we could hardly see it, we can't without a microscope, which possesses the ultimate capacity to construct every living thing. I got it right here. Thanks, Dale. Every living thing that has ever existed on Earth, from the giant redwood to the human brain. It can construct all its own components in a matter of minutes. And it's on the order of several thousand million times smaller than the smallest piece of functional machinery ever constructed by puny man. That's the fraction. 1,000th of a million or something. That's how many times smaller it is than our smallest machine that we've ever made. And now continuing with Behe, not only is the ribosome amazing, he said, but now you're faced with a challenge of getting these new components into the right rooms inside the cell where they can operate. And in order to do that, you'd have to have another complicated system. So he's already talked about complexity. You have to have another system, just like you need a lot of things in place for a Greyhound bus to take someone from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. First of all, you got to have molecular trucks. I warned you about this, which are enclosed and have motors attached to them. And if you read his book about the flagellum, the little motor that runs these things around can spin at 10,000 RPM and can reverse directions in a microsecond. The motor itself has an armature and field windings all made out of proteins. And that's another whole topic. Get the book, read about it. Now you've got to have little highways for them to travel along. You've got to be able to identify which components are supposed to go into which truck. Doesn't do any good if you just grab any protein that comes along, because each one needs to go to an own specific room where it belongs and where it can function and provide health. So there has to be a signal attached to the protein, a sort of a ticket to let the protein get onto the right truck. Truck has to know where it's going, which means having a signal on the truck itself, and a complementary signal on the little room, the compartment, where the truck is supposed to unload its cargo. And remember, each compartment has a door, too. So there's these signals and these complementary signals. And we don't understand the nature of those signals. When the truck arrives, it's where it's supposed to go. It's kind of like a big ocean liner that has just crossed from London to New York. It pulls up at the dock and everybody's waving, but oops. We forgot the gangplank. Now what are we going to do? So you see, you've got to have a way for the cargo to get out of the truck and into the compartment. And it turns out this is an active process. It's not random. It's not an accident. That involves other components recognizing each other, physically opening up the little door and allowing the material to go inside. I can hardly comprehend. So you've got numerous components. This is the key now. Pay attention. All of which have to be in place all at once, right now, together, or nothing works. If you don't have the signal, if you don't have the truck, you're pretty much out of luck. Now, does this microscopic transportation system sound like something that's self-assembled by gradual modifications over the years? Mutations, adaptations. I don't see how it could happen, have been, that's Michael Behe speaking again. The stuff has to be there all at once or nothing works. It can't build up gradually. To me, this is Michael Behe speaking, it has all the earmarks of being designed. And there's one more. I'll just go with one more from Michael Behe. What are these things pictured? Red blood cells, yeah. And what is all this gunk that's over these red blood cells and some white cells there? Plaque? This is beneficial stuff. This is good stuff. At the right time, it's a blood clot. And this is mentioned in Darwin's Black Box, too. And there's a cascade when Barb's brother-in-law, her sister's husband is a pathologist, and he said, I was talking to him about this, and he said, when we studied this in med school, we had a book that thick, this tall, and so wide, just on blood clotting. It had, I don't know how many hundreds of pages, just on the blood clotting mechanism. He says, I never fully understood it, but I learned enough to pass the test. The blood clotting cascade in Darwin's Black Box, pages 85 and onward, you can read about that in more detail. So again, Michael Behe, suppose you get cut on your finger. Would this small opening in your tissue be any problem for you if it didn't clot and shut down? If you kept bleeding? If the blood could not or would not clot just right, it could be a problem. Blood clotting involves timing and amount. If your blood doesn't clot in the right place and in the right amount and at the right time, you could bleed to death. As it turns out, the system of blood clotting involves a highly choreographed cascade of 10 steps, that use about 20 different molecular components. And without the whole system in place, it won't work. The real trick with blood clotting isn't so much the clot. It's just a blob that blocks the flow of blood. You saw that picture, and that was an electromicrograph of it. But it's the regulation of the system, he continues. If you make a clot in the wrong place, say in your brain, that happens, you know, to some people, get an aneurysm, or in your lung, you'll die. And if you make a clot 20 minutes after all the blood is drained out of your body, you'll die. Michael Behe, you are cuckoo there. If the blood's already drained out of you, you're already dead. But that's what he says in his book. That's a quote. I had to laugh when I read that one. And if the clot isn't confined to the cut on your finger, your entire blood system might solidify and you would die. So this clotting is very precisely controlled to be in the right place at the right time. If you make a clot that doesn't cover the entire length of the cut, you could die. To create a perfectly balanced blood clotting system, clusters of proteins and components have to be inserted all at once. And that rules out a gradualistic Darwinian approach and fits the hypothesis of an intelligent designer. There are more problems than that. This I hadn't thought of until I read this in his book. How can blood clotting develop over time, step by step, adaptation, mutations, natural selection? In the meantime, the animal has no effective defense if it's still developing little by little, or a way to stop from bleeding to death whenever it's injured or cut. Good point, huh? Good point. And when you've got the components sitting around doing nothing in their adaptation and mutations and natural selection only works if there's something useful for it to do right now, not in the future. Natural selection fails to explain this simple process that we take for granted. Hasn't everyone here had a cut of one time or another in your life, maybe serious cuts? You've had the blood clotting going on. We don't like to have that happen to us, but he makes a good point. It has to be there all at once. It cannot be gradualistic. Fearfully and wonderfully evolved, fearfully and wonderfully made, which. And there's two kinds of evolution. I believe in evolution. I do. I believe in this one here, microevolution. Because it can be demonstrated. It's all around us. And I believe that some of the kinds that came off the ark have done microevolution to give us different dog types, for example. It is also the change in gene frequencies of a population over time. But macroevolution is another story completely. On a large scale includes changes such as the appearance, the evolution of new species from a common ancestor, or the evolution of one species splitting off into two. Totally different story. And here they are illustrated. On the left, you have macroevolution, where it is proposed that slime molds, something small in the primordial sea, began to generate proteins and develop into sea creatures and finally land animals and then man. And microevolution says, well, all the dog types that you see, wolves, Chihuahuas, all dog type, right? And they have adapted and developed, and they can be bred to produce show-winning dogs, some beautiful creatures. I just met a fellow on my walk this morning, and I've met him a couple times, had a poodle. And that poodle, white poodle, was so well-behaved, he came right up and said good morning to me in dog talk. And I petted him. And we had a good little visit there. And this poodle was very friendly. Oh, that's like the gray one up there. There it's pictured in vertical format. You got the varieties down below, species, genus, family, order, class as you go on up. The kinds mentioned in the Bible would be down lower. Microevolution is down in that low region. Macroevolution lets things go right on up to scale. And you know what the Bible says? Of fowls after their kind, cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, not turning into some other kind. Then we turn to Jonathan Wells, which is another interesting book. His Icons of Evolution was recommended to me by Kent Cost, the fellow that took my job over there at Campion when I left. He teaches the stuff I used to teach. He says, read this book, Williams, and so I did, and so I bring to you some of the quotes in it. The most controversial aspect of Darwin's theory has been its implication for how we got here. Darwin's view had two implications, which were and continue to be especially controversial. Here they are. Humans are nothing but animals. Some people act like that. And they are not the preordained goal of any sort of directed process. Jonathan Wells, page 209. The ultimate icon of Darwin's theory, you've probably seen this icon, may be the illustration of an ape-like creature evolving through a series of hypothetical intermediate forms into modern man. How many have seen that kind of picture? And its implications for the ultimate meaning of human existence. Are we just animals? How would you answer that? I see a lot of head shaking going this way. Darwin began The Descent of Man, that was a treatise that he made, by reminding readers that man is constructed on the same general type or model as other mammals. Man bears in his bodily structure clear traces of his descent from some lower form. For Darwin, the continuity between animals and humans extended even to morality and religion. Thus, the feeling of religious devotion is merely a higher form of the deep love of a dog for his master. Interestingly, neither Huxley, who was a co-contributor to some of this, nor Darwin believed that living apes were our ancestors. They believed that they were some other apes that were our ancestors. Page 216 from Icons of Evolution. And the claim that humans are mere animals is not the only philosophical pill we are expected to swallow. You can tell which side of the fence Jonathan Wells is on. He's very much a creationist. Since the 1970s, the ultimate icon has increasingly been used to promote the idea, the doctrine, that evolution was undirected, totally random, and that our existence is a mere accident. One consequence of the belief in the survival of the fittest, you've certainly heard of that, is its tacit approval of the many examples in history where one race or ethnic group exterminates another. Some of that's still going on over there in the Middle East, such as that shown by the Nazis in the murdering of millions of Jews. To such evolutionists, the Holocaust was simply an application of letting the fittest survive. Wells, in his book, concludes that by observing, evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion. And I think it takes faith to believe that. And it takes faith to believe in creation. Secular religion, and like so many other things we have encountered, this is not science, but myth. Jonathan Wells said that. So we have this question. Do we take what science proclaims as the absolute truth, and how do we contrast that with what Scripture says? We're going to look at some of the verses that point out certain things from the psalmist, Psalm 100. The Lord, He is God. It's He that made us and not we ourselves. God created man in His own image. In the image of God created He him. Male and female created He them. From Genesis. And there's many more. I don't know how many hundreds of more we could look at, but I just have a few. For by him were all things created that are in heaven, that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions, or principalities or powers, all things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and by him all things consist. Your body holds together the breaths that you take, that I take, and my heart beats. I thank the Lord every day for all those things. Each day I wake up. God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds. Men today declare that Christ's teachings concerning God cannot be substantiated by the things of the natural world, that nature is just not in harmony with the Old and New Testament scriptures. This supposed lack of harmony between nature and science does not exist. The Word of God of heaven is not in harmony with human science, but in perfect accord with his own created science. This is from The Upward Look, from Ellen White, page 278. God's science is in harmony with his Word. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, the same was in the beginning with God. John the Beloved writing this. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. In him was life. Ellen White says, original, unborrowed, underived. And I would like to change that was this way. In life, in him is life. My life, your life. Original, unborrowed, underived. The human eye is another one that's well written up as being irreducibly complex. Could not have evolved step by step because it wouldn't work properly. It would have been discarded if it was no use to the creature. That's all written in some of those books that I mentioned to you. That is still a puzzle for those that are trying to develop a religion that does not involve the Creator God. Any of you see this exhibit that was at the Denver Science Museum a few years back called Body Works? I see a few of you shaking your head. Had all these people that had donated their bodies to science, and somehow they were able to replace tissues with this plastic material or whatever it was. The biology teacher, Bob Nobuhara, who was at Campion when I was, he took his A&P class to see this. They were there the whole time allotted for the field trip, and they begged, we didn't finish, can we go back? And they went back two more times just to look at all this stuff and try to digest it. It was fascinating just how all this, because they could look at this and say, boy, the body really is that complex. Fearfully and wonderfully designed, fearfully and wonderfully evolved. You take the largest cell that is produced by any human, the female egg, largest cell, and you couple it with the very smallest cell that is made by the human body, the sperm. And if the sperm is successful in penetrating the outer wall, an embryo begins. That's how each one of you, how I began one time. And we developed where that big cell that was impregnated split into two and then into four and then into how many? 8 and then 16 and then 32 and then 64, 128, 256, 512, 10, 24, 20, 48. And more cells appeared. Baby growing larger and larger. Saw on Facebook. Strange thing that says, isn't it amazing to see all these women marching for the right to destroy their own babies? And of course, all babies arrive with a stork carrying this big hook. And they're so tiny. And I was so glad when our two sons were born. I checked both feet to see if all little five were there, both Annie's. And by the grace of God, our sons were born with everything in place. And some poor parents don't have that joyous event happen to them. Seeing a little child program its computer is fun to watch, isn't it, you parents? We just love to see our kids learn and grow and do more and more. You are indeed fearfully and wonderfully made, as someone wrote on the heel of their baby, on the foot. They wrote that on their little baby's foot, and it grabbed my heart. So we're left with two choices. The naturalistic, humanistic, Darwinian evolutionary approach. The biblical, God is creator, intelligent designer approach. You have a decision to make. And Joshua proposed that this decision was key. A watershed moment when Joshua spoke to the people. For he said, if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom ye will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And I don't think it's doing injustice to Scripture to say serve involves certainly as well belief. So I'm going to paraphrase this. If it seem evil unto you to believe the Lord, choose ye this day whom ye will believe. But as for me and my Barbie and my family and my house, we will believe the Lord who loved us and created us and designed us. So I encourage you to choose one or the other. We aren't going to condemn you for believing either way. Jesus stands at the door of our hearts, Revelation 3 says, and he gently knocks and speaks. He doesn't force belief on anyone, but he is calling you to believe in him because he loved you so much that he spilled his own blood to save you.